For Always Record episode 116, we have a special surprise. This is some audio that was recorded on the night of 420 going into 421. We have these monthly Google Hangouts for SyncBook Plus members. You can find out about this at thesyncbook.com/membership. This is some audio from later in the night that we ended up reconnecting after a series of technical difficulties. Some of the people were able to come back in, and there's a bunch of people in this call. Amazing crew, and please enjoy. Thanks. I have an obsession with the number 317, but there's also, in quantum physics, right, there's 1 divided by 37. We spoke to David Peet. He said David Bohm was obsessed with the number 137, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, it's a fine structure constant.
Right. And, but even so, like, even though it wasn't the fraction, he said the number 137 always came to him, right?
Yeah.
But, of course, we see it as a fraction in quantum physics. For myself, I have number 317. There's also Tenor, the Japanese blogger, did something about another variation. Anyway, I start thinking, 13-month-old baby, 7 years, and I'm like, and I've also considered the common number given for the age of the universe. They say the Big Bang happened, 13.7 years ago? 13.7 billion years ago?
That's their best guess.
Right. So, 13.7, right? So we get with the 13 and the 7.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there and I'm like, I wonder if there's anything, if I divided 13 by 7, what that would give me. I'm like, maybe there's a mathematical key to that. Alright, and I'm just driving along, and I'm thinking all these things, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, maybe 13 divided by 7, right? Well, I get stuck in traffic, okay? And I'm stuck behind this fucking big-ass truck. And at some point, I sort of start looking, you know, I'm just sitting there. At some point, I look at the fucking truck. Someone spray-painted on the back of the truck, but it was small, but it was there.
Mm-hmm.
7 over 13. It was almost as if I'm sitting there going, should I divide 13 divided by 7? And the universe said, no, asshole, you got it backwards. 7 divided by 13. Right? And I'm like, okay. So I tried to snap a picture, and I wrote it on my hand, and I'm like, okay, I have to remember this. But I have no idea what that means. It was like, I was pondering it, and it was as if the universe gave me the correct formula, or whatever you want to call it, but I still don't know what 7 divided by 13 or what the connotation there is. And I'm just curious if that does Wally from like a musical perspective, or John from anybody, you know, like what's...
I was just typing 7 divided by 13, and I was like, hey, that was my area code, 713, when I was growing up. That's my contribution.
One thing, Alan, When you had the 137, I think, John, you guys talked about one of your old records, and it was Wolfgang Pauli was obsessed with this number. And,
oh, it was Pauli, that's it, yes.
Yeah,
Pauli.
Anytime I hear a number, my first question is it odd? Okay, is it prime? Okay, yes, it is prime. And then this is the 33rd prime. And so it, to me, triggered into all the 33 mysteries of, like, the apotheosis of, you know, just the Masonic. I mean, you know, so I just think it added to the mystery of this 137 for me, just hearing from the prime number perspective. But yeah, 7 over 13 is 0.538, if that doesn't mean anything to anybody. But yeah, just to throw that up. And that's what kicked me off into the 17 prime issues. I don't know if you saw that in my write up in that article, but the number 17 is this fascinating prime number, and the reason why I started in all that research was this Wolfgang Pauli discussion you guys had on Always Record.
Hmm.
You about the nature of prime. Anyhow,
it's funny because in Mark's talk tonight, he was talking about the number 17. Him and Marty Weeds discussed number 17 a little bit. And it's funny because I've been obsessed with 17 for so many years. And everybody finds it interesting for a completely different reason. But there is something very real there. There's something to that number. I don't fucking know. You know, everybody finds
it's
a different
weird special number. I mean, yeah.
Well, then Mark was. I think that's what Mark said. Like 17 by 17 equals 4096. I think that's his angle, or something like that. How he got there, I don't fucking know. But that's he uses it for that. And I know, yeah, it's just like, it's probably my most important number. I don't know, it's, I guess all these numbers intervene in our lives in certain ways. They take on a constellation in our heads, but they're all significant. And I'll say that, like, it's a little annoying, though, to have them take on enough significance where you, I don't know, it's, I don't want to be looking for them everywhere. I have other stuff to do, and it's, like, fun sometimes, but also I start annoying myself, because I'm like, well, since it's happening in your life, you don't really have to look for it, per se. It's like, Alan, in your case, it's just going to be, like, on the front of the truck right in front of you. I shouldn't have to do all this puzzle solving, because then I'm just constructing, I'm just making stuff up. It's not really sync. So I'm always, like, dangerous, or I always feel dangerous playing with numbers too much in that regard, but just the fact that it's jumping out at you that hard is just funny. It's just cool. It's just, like, again, it's just, like, it doesn't have to mean anything beyond, hey, here's a little pattern that I'm showing you that it's both subjective, objective at the same time. This is sync, so it's still with you. It's just like a wink, but it's not important necessarily. That's like, I don't know. I guess I'm, as someone that's trying to not go insane, that's how I'm trying to retain some sanity with it.
One of the things I'm
talking about.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just saying before, it's interesting because Misty was, she was saying that we had this synchronicity when you guys were talking about 17. I guess John had texted her, and then we were having this whole discussion about the star and the number 17. Of course, that's the tarot trump.
Yeah.
And our discussion was really about this idea of groundedness in the insanity of the kind of psychedelic extremes of synchronicity. You know, 42 Minutes just had this person on, and they were talking about how he kind of got really tripped out there, and David Bowie got tripped out, and you know, this idea of being the body, the star is the first trump within person, and she's on the ground kneeling. So we're talking about groundedness and kind of as an antidote to this, the risk of kind of tripping out too far. So it's interesting you bring that up, John. And Doug was talking about how he would literally dig his hands in the dirt sometimes when he got too far out there to just kind of feel kind of feel these other elements. So I just find that interesting.
It's going to be really spooky, because it's so obvious when you're getting it heavy. It's like, again, these little games I'm playing with the numbers, I can take them and leave them, and these little things enter my life and they leave them, and I recognize them as sync, and looking back at my life, I've seen them for a long, long time. But then you go through a cluster where it's like, what? It feels very like you have a foot in both worlds for a while. I don't know. I don't know if you guys ever got this, but I would just term them empty vessel moments. A lot of people just parroting either your own thoughts or something you were just talking about with someone else, or something that gives extreme insight into what you're going through, even though it's like an argument outside your door, two strangers arguing about something that's like close to what you're dealing with. It's so fucking weird, and it spooks you out. I don't know. It's good to like have just this cluster of people to look at, because everyone's gone through it in their own way, at least in some way, shape, or form, whether it's big or small. Like, I haven't had a lot of large episodes, but what I have had has been pretty intense. But most of it's just like small, you know, like, oh, I was doing these drawings when I was young, and now I'm really into these kinds of geometrical questions and so on. It's just, I know, Alan, you've put that in some of your writing too, and that, you know, there's minor premonition in the art you do, and the automatic drawing or writing or whatever it is. It's just like tapping into that unconscious dimension, and it's like you were tethered to something pulling you from the future. It's kind of weird.
Oh, prime, I'm muted. Can I hear from you guys? So we have John. So John is a carpenter. SJ is a photographer. Wally's a musician. You know, sort of. What do you guys find as far as you know, the artistic expression being connected to these sort of, you know, altered states in the sense of how John was describing, and I'm just like, you know, intoxicated or psychedelic, but the sort of altered time space.
Well, I'll say, I mean, for me, like, photography is such a present moment. It's like the athletes describe getting on the court, and they're playing, you know, at these almost visceral and sort of somatic levels. It's just a kind of this, they're just the athlete, the zone, I guess they call it. For me, photography is all about the zone. And once you enter the zone and you're actually doing the heavy lifting of the work, it's almost like what happens doesn't make itself known sometimes for even years afterwards. Like, for instance, my big thing was the 42. I did this whole project, you guys know, the Lost Dog, before the Sync Book Press even started, and it was 42. And it sort of propelled me into connection with you guys. So I feel like it's still reverberating some of the things that happened in that state of the zone. Anyhow, I just throw that out there, that there does seem to be some kind of metaphysical element that kind of comes through for me. And it's very easy to tap into. I mean, I don't know. That's how I know I'm on the right path often. And it's just kind of, oh, this is, I'm not having to struggle for this. It's just, I'm in that groove, you know. But yeah, it's that, I don't know, that reverberating quality, unpredictable nature of art. One of my favorite photographers, Robert Adams, always says, I go out and make photographs, but I have no idea what's going to happen. And often the ones that are the best are ones that are just, I got lucky. It was like a magic sort of sync, coincidence, I guess. Accidents, happy accidents.
Well, and it's
just
like
a tree over it. The happy accident.
what was that?
Were you talking about Bob Ross, the happy little accident? I said, yeah, you just tree over it.
Accidental initiation, that whole title of the book, but yeah, no. Just, you know, the artists talk, like, you see the Rolling Stones, that video where they're making Sympathy for the Devil, and how it's just kind of unfolds. It didn't seem very planned, you know. They just kind of opened up the mind space. And then something came through, you know.
So, Wally, I heard, like I said, it was like total, my computer could have freezing. But I heard you say something in that previous call that we did. Mm. You said something about, you were referring to this as being related to jazz.
Oh, yeah.
Which I've thought about a lot myself. I'm curious if you could kind of...
Well, yeah, I got the idea. I was listening to a podcast on SyncBook Radio. I forget which one now. I was kind of binging on it a few days ago. And somebody mentioned that their process is kind of like jazz. And what I said on the last show, in my own little, you know, response to just kind of encountering this community and just kind of, you know, because you had mentioned in either one of your shows, or I think maybe some footage I saw from the summit, about taking a kind of journalistic approach to the analysis that you guys are doing, which I thought was a great way to describe it. And in the last call, what I said is, I feel like, or my response to the kind of work that you guys are doing here is that, in a kind of weird way, it feels like the natural evolution of jazz. What I mean by that is, it's kind of like, I make that statement kind of in the spirit of Marshall McLuhan, who is another hero of mine. What I mean by that is, you know, in the age of jazz, when it really kind of became established into what we recognize it as today, which would have been in the mid-40s with the formation of the first really small jazz combos, like four-piece, five-piece combos, like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and the original bebop combos. Before that, they were just all big bands. And these guys were, you know, they grew up in the age of radio, and that was their media, print and radio, basically. And so they were these kind of walking encyclopedias of the media of their time, which was sound-based, and they were musically very adept and able to kind of, you know, they were full of information about all of the music of their time, and these combos would get together in these little clubs, and they all knew the same standard songs. They weren't called standards back then. They were just the pop music of the last 30 years, and they would take the basic form of these songs, you know, that they all knew, and then they would just completely discombobulate them with all of their musical trickery and constantly quoting and referencing and just, you know, tearing it up with each other and debating and arguing musically. And they were conversing with the media that was predominant in their time. And today, you know, obviously media is capable of, you know, taking any form, whether it's film or music or literature, et cetera. And, you know, listening to all these podcasts and everything and just kind of, and watching a lot of these videos of theories of all of these different pop culture films and stuff, it just felt like jazz. You know, I mean, it's just like all of these walking encyclopedias of media just kind of coming together and jamming, really, but now using the language of all media. And so that was kind of the point, I guess, I was trying to make. So
I also see parallels between, as far as like art movements and sync, Dadaism.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, that was actually pointed out to me not too long ago. But it's like, oh yeah, that's a pretty good analogy. And as far as like a magical paradigm goes, I think it's as close to Discordianism as you can get. But Discordianism was too funny. I think we take ourselves too seriously to be Discordians, but we're at least in that spirit. And Alan especially embodies like the Robert Anton Wilson principle of just acknowledging our limitations of perception and what we should say and not shouldn't say about these phenomenon is, you know, so he does an amazing job of walking that line. It's really hard to maintain. I've tried to get better at it. I'm naturally dogmatic, like I think all of us are.
Yeah.
So to hold that middle position and be like, well, you know, it could be this, it could be that. It's not easy to do. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of just the, you know, the limits of the perception, I think, you know, what McLuhan talks about is and how you can take a kind of perspective of through media itself. Is, you know, all media, all technology in general, he says, is an extension of various parts of the human body. And, you know, like a car is the extension of the foot, glasses are an extension of your eyeballs, clothes are an extension of your skin, etc. And so, you know, these tools that we come to rely on as extensions of, you know, that allow us to supersede the limitations of our perception, so to speak, end up kind of rewiring our brain in a way that...
Right. Like, where does supersession... Right, if we supersede it, I mean, where does that take us? It just takes us into a new dimension of abstraction, because it's...
Exactly.
The universe is so deep and so big.
Right.
You know, we're just like, it's... I think a lot of what we're trying to do is a fool's errand, but at the same time... Yeah, I'm more interested in exploring man, you know, our minds. I think we just take those for granted, and we're always looking to the stars and this and that, and like, well, it's like there's not look at the planet, it's fucking in a horrible shape, people are acting like assholes, why don't we address that first, before, like, oh, we need space colonies and shit, it's like, why, so we can go, be a
we
virus
can go
somewhere
make a mess
else.
Over there.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, I don't think space wants us, so it's like, we gotta figure out what's happening here, and I think sync and, you know, there's no going backwards. Like, we're not going to go back to fucking indigenous culture as we knew it or anything. And so within what we have, which is very vacuous and soulless in a lot of ways and materialistic and pointlessly competitive, and I could go on and on, there have to be ways to get people in touch with that unconscious side of themselves. And Sync is the most accessible. Because what are you going to do? Go tell them to do Crowley ceremony magic? I mean, sure. Whatever. It's like, well, no.
I feel like there's this idea of holding multiple ideas in one's head is not just to, you know, for the idea of ultimate subjectivity, but for me to try, like, when we talk about communication, and you're trying to convey an idea to me, I need to see it. I can get a concept, but I'll never fully see it through your eyes. You said the eyes are the extension of, you know, it's like the glasses being the extension of the eye, but to say the perspective is unique to each person, right?
Right.
So
right.
All I can do is attempt to try and wear your perspective, like a pair of glasses, or a shirt or whatever,
right,
for a moment and try and see. And I think this is why the idea of viewing multiple, or being able to hold multiple things, and then allowing those things to communicate, this was where the jazz idea sort of really speaks to me. I'm not a musician. I wish to God that I could... that I was, or that I understood that language. I don't. But while you were talking, it occurred to me that only once in my life, so you know, like some people, they can close their eyes and like picture something, right? Like,
sure.
You know, like I can't do that. I can conceptualize something. I do a lot of visual art, but I can't close my eyes and picture something. I can't actually see it. I can conceptualize it. It's probably why I do art, is because I have to do the work to make it come kind of close. My friend used to say, he's like, I mean, you can't just like close your eyes and picture this girl naked or something. I'm like, dude, if I could, I'd never leave the fucking house. You know, I was like, I can't do that. You know, it's like, that's a sort of joking example, but my point is, I can't. And I can't do that with music either, but it was on a 420. Now, this is a big holiday for me, but it's just funny. It was on a 420 a number of years ago, and I can distinctly remember sitting up on my roof, smoking some weed, and there was pizza, and I'm just suddenly, I heard this music, and I was trying so hard to convey to people. It's like, you don't hear that? Like, I remember writing it down. I was like, because I was like, I could reproduce this. It was actually music that I knew I could somehow reproduce. I was like, it's like if you could play the bass line from Steve Miller Band's Jet Airliner with this, you know, like, I was like, as you said, it was speaking in the encyclopedia of music when you said these people walking around with this in their heads. I was walking around with all these little snippets of things,
sure,
that somehow something triggered in my brain that I could hear them all at once, and the way they spoke to each other, the way that they perfectly complemented each other.
Right.
But it was only in that brief moment that I was able to hold those four different, you know, or five different songs or instruments together in my brain at once.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, these are like the truly transcendent sync moments, is when I can understand your perspective and SJ's perspective and John's perspective and the other John's perspective, and if there's a moment where I can go, oh, fuck, I get it. Okay, we're all kind of hitting on the same thing, but, you know, of course we're going to all have our own spin on it, or our own biases, or our own whatever, our perspectives, you know, we bring ourselves into it. But if there's those moments where we can transcend that, and I can understand each of your perspectives at once and get a little bit outside my own limitations, that to me is where these conversations can be that kind of transcendent jazz, if that makes any sense.
It does.
Like a sense of feeding off of each other too. I mean, like, you know, the ideas of totalizing theories that are kind of monolithic, we got to get over that, obviously, but I learned so much from just like listening to Always Record or John's show or any of these shows. It's feeding my perception. It's like a reinvigorating and making new the perceptive possibilities that I can bring to my present moments that are going to be coming in the future. You know, so there's a sort of a necessity, and I think this idea of human beings being a communal thing. I mean, we're not on an island, right? We're this is all about connecting and connecting with each other. And so, anyhow, I'm I think there's a real promising and hopeful element to sharing perspective. I mean, these are obvious things as I'm saying them, but even in the, from the syncing perspective, you know, it's like I hear I'll record 137, oh, then that triggers something in me, then it triggers my research, and we kind of build off of each other. So it's beautiful.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about listening to all these recordings is always not understanding what you guys are talking about, resonating with what you're talking about, like sort of getting it. But then, like, thinking about it more, or learning something else somewhere else, and realizing, hey, those things are like all the same, right? Like going back with Dave Plate's Tree of Life stuff. Him, like, you know, every time he named one of the Sephiroth, I was like, man, I gotta understand that a little bit better. And it's sort of a push. With my art, I don't know how. I just make like objects, and they don't really. My reason why I like making things is I like making things that are useful, right? Things that. That add to people's lives instead of having like crappy light switch plates where you go and you turn the light on and off and it's just a piece of plastic that you look at all the time. Something just a little nicer, just to add a little bit extra to your life. Sometimes some of my work is like I like making onks and like little figurines that are like little Mama Pachas, or a little while ago I made a little Bes, which is like a little Egyptian god, and so you know I only make them because those things had power for people in other times, and sometimes those things can have power for people now, but I only make them for the power that other people perceive in those things, you know? I don't do it because I see power in them. Like I'm making a wand for someone right now.
Someone nearby.
And, like, I don't believe in magic, but when I'm making it, I make pretend that I do. Like, I want it to be a magical object, even if the person that I'm giving it to believes or doesn't believe in the magic. I want to make it, like, all the tools that I use, I made myself when I'm making the wand. And I only do that because I heard that that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to make your own tools to put the magic into into the object. So I don't know how, as far as my carpentry goes, how I don't see how it relates to, you know, it's hard for me to put synchronicity into it, or you know.
No, I totally see it because, you know. Number one, you are getting into a zone. Number two, it's the grounded side of it. Like you guys, yeah, SJ said with the, you know, the 17 and the star and grounding and all this sort of stuff. To me, this is what, this is why I have frustration when people talk about, like, Saturnian, quote-unquote Saturnian being a bad thing. And to me, it's a very necessary thing sometimes. The physical, the material, the grounded, you know, people think of this as like base because we all want to transcend and be happy little star children and shit. But, you know, that physical object is incredibly real. You know, I'm hesitant to say it's more real than these abstract ideas, but I'm saying it's, if we can at least call it a different end of the spectrum. But it's, I've had a really hard time over the last number of years really trying to convey the importance of balancing those two things, where it's like you can have your head in the clouds and your feet on the ground type thing.
Yeah. I'm like that, totally. I feel I am, anyways.
Exactly. So to me, the physical carvings are the grounded objects. You know, they are the feet on the ground. They are the earthly. You know, I'm not trying to sound like mystical. I'm trying to be very.
Yeah. That works.
I think they're hugely important. It's like it's a hugely important energetic or concept or however you want to say that.
Yeah. Well, like I make a spoon, right? It's the same kind of thing, right? lots of people have metal spoons, but you know when you're making something with a spoon that you like, it makes a difference. You know, if you like cooking and you're using a spoon that you like to use, it makes a difference in your cooking. You know, it gives you an extra little bit of enjoyment, and that carries on with other things. Like, I'm not saying, or I don't think that, that my, like, what I make doesn't affect other people. It's just, you know, there's sort of a little bit of a separation where I'm just making it, and the other people, like, they're the ones that are getting the, they're the ones that are putting the concept into it, right? No matter what I've done, you know?
But isn't the same to be said for any of us? Like, SJ takes the photograph. He's just making it. The other person has to come and interpret it, and they're either gonna go, that's a shitty photograph. Or they're going to be like, that's a beautiful photograph. Or they're going to be like, holy shit, that takes me to another world, or whatever.
That reminded me of my dad.
Right. You know, someone's going to hear Wally's music or see his film and go, oh, okay. They have to bring themselves to it. You guys are convincing me of this as you speak by saying, hey, I listened to Wally's record and it reminded me of Bubba, or it made me consider this concept, whatever it is. For me, I'm making it, and then it goes out into the world. I have no control over it. I have no... Yeah, so it's like, what does the next person do with it? It's just, we're like past objects through time, but someone else is going to have a different use for it, or a different...
Ingression into novelty. I don't know if you guys heard the Artie Leeds interview with Dennis McKenna, but... I think there's an element of that in play too. Just we're kind of all, as we collectively kind of release things and then inspire people, you know, we may be going into some kind of novelty, technologically speaking, you know, or in, you know, in internally, spiritually. I mean, a lot of theories about like the singularity. Maybe there's going to be an AI Godhead. I just saw that movie Ex Machina. I don't know. It's just out. Yeah, that's an interesting.
I mean, every moment is infinite novelty, though. That's what's so interesting. It's like, oh, we're going to reach a point of infinite novelty. We're already there. It's like,
yeah,
it's
yeah, every waking moment. Yeah.
It's like, what are we waiting for? No, you know?
I don't think there's one point. In that interview, they talk about that. Dennis says, well, Terrence got all tripped out on finding the perfect one point, as opposed to just the idea that it's getting more novel.
And yeah.
Being the real breakthrough.
It's always a process. There is no end. Or if there is an omega point, it's like, I don't know. I don't know what to make of a beginning or an end. It seems like everything is an ongoing process. And
well, I thought it was like there wasn't, his point was there wasn't an end or a beginning, but there was just points, right? And it sort of, it comes to a point and then it just carries on, right? The wave repeats itself.
Okay, yeah, I totally...
That was my figuring out.
I can wrap my head around that. And there's a concept, I'm forgetting where it's embodied, but, like, I think it's just in, like, a simple ripple of a pond. If it's going, like, out and it bounces back in on itself, it's in a contained space, basically the wave reaches the center, and then it does kind of, like, a flip, and then it bounces back out. So it's, like, this constant, yeah, it just shifts into a new space, so it doesn't end, per se, or it doesn't begin, per se. But, I think, like, with singularity and stuff, it just, I mean, I can't object to it, I guess, on intellectual grounds. At the same time, I think it's fetishizing and kind of silly, and we're putting all kinds of money in pointless technologies, but that's just my perspective on it. I mean, it's someone else's religion. It's religion for atheists. It's weird. It's like, just accept that you're just say you're spiritual or something, instead of just, like, pretending you're this objective, tough guy scientist, except there's no God, but there might be a supercomputer I can download my consciousness into. It's like, what the fuck? Just, it doesn't make... I don't like it.
Totally
I don't like it.
Totally.
That's all. That's all. So it's like, it's cool. Like, AI's all good. I mean, whatever. It's if we could... sure, maybe we'll make consciousness or something. It's... I don't know. I don't want them
to
be my...
I don't think AI is possible.
I don't think it is either, but it's like, yeah. I can't say it's impossible,
and
you know?
It may have already even happened, and if it is possible, I don't know that we'd ever notice.
Well, here's what's going on. It already has happened, because we're already ruled by institutions.
Clarification? How are you guys defining, like, do you mean as far as, like,
technological? Artificial, yeah, artificial intelligence.
Consciousness or artificial, I'm just curious.
I think that the definition of AI has evolved as our own ideas of what AI could be has evolved. So right now it seems to be like a essentially, you know, a machine capable of learning and a machine capable of consciousness. And
self-propagating.
Yeah.
But the singularity is the moment when their intelligence allegedly trumps humans, and at that point, there's all sorts of, like, doomsday
scenarios. Accelerated thing, yeah.
Right, and then at that point we become their ass slaves, and, you know, then it's...
That's why, I guess, yeah, when you say, like, there's a distinction between it becoming more intelligent. Like, we can have a robot beat somebody at Jeopardy or chess, but exactly. that doesn't mean that that computer can, have a... You know, quote unquote, enlightenment or feeling, all the that whole spectrum of.
Well, a lot of the existing
spectrums we can't hit either. You know,
a lot of the existing work based on just like with Ray Kurzweil and some of the knowledge-based computing stuff, and all the ways in which the stuff that kind of drives something like Watson, from what. You know, I'm not an expert. From what I've been able to glean from it, though, it's a lot of the kind of stuff that they're feeding those machines and the software is very language based and all about natural language and machine readable ontologies and natural language processing. But all of the language that they're teaching is just print based and verbal language. And I guess my own philosophies convictions that AI isn't really possible is because human communication is just so much more broad in terms of the ways in, you know, the media in which it can be carried out that and the human capacity for communication in ways that we don't even know exist yet are going to continue to expand in a way I don't think a machine will ever really be able to keep up with. So it's not just verbal or written based language that a machine is going to need to know in order to even appear intelligent.
Is there like was it Burroughs, the idea of like language is a virus? Is that like we are essentially infecting our AI with the language virus, like linear print based thought?
Yeah, because I think there's so many other kinds of languages besides just words, essentially.
Or the biological language of like epigenetics and the mystery of the genome. That's why I tend to be skeptical. Is like there's some kind of biological core here that I don't think that how can a machine replicate? I mean, I'm just skeptical. I'm open minded but skeptical.
Sure, sure.
And like basically, a lot of the research, it's all highly compartmentalized. It's a hodgepodge of, oh, we're working on vision, we're working on this, we're working on that, and then they think they can just
fragmented.
Yeah, and then they think they can just bring it together, at the goal line and just pull it all together. It's not going to happen that way. And
it seems more like in mainstream science, like disciplines continue converging, and like you know, there's more and more like lectures online of like a guy from the physics department lecturing the biology department. He's like spends half the time just justifying being there, and they're like embarrassed that their disciplines are converging, as if you know.
It's dirty.
And then suddenly they accept that it's connected, and it's like, oh, we knew all along. You know?
But it's still slow. It's slow. I mean, academics are slow because it's still people's needs hierarchy are programmed into their positions and what they say and what they do, so they have to stay conservative and preserve their ideas as long as they can, because that keeps them fed and well
and employed
and, you know, esteem. I mean, people are hungry for status because we're all just like, you know, we're fucking primates, and so everyone's just looking for status in their own way, and we've facilitated that in the intellectual domain. It's like you don't have to kill your rival anymore to like be top dog. You just have to rise to the top of some sort of intellectual institution, and I don't know, it'd be a PR voice or push paper or something.
True that.
Well, are you guys still cool for going for a little bit? I know it's late for some of us. I don't know. It's 1:20 here.
Oh my, yeah. I'm on the West Coast, so.
Oh, you're still good. So it's like I'm a night owl anyway, so I'm happy to go for like another 20 minutes or so. Because I'm the one recording, so it's just like I don't want to bail, and if everyone's still got stuff to say, so at the very least I can just sit here and listen.
Yeah, I can go for 20 minutes.
Okay.
Sounds or it's 20 after 12 here in Austin.
Okay, yeah. So we'll aim for that, and if it's still going strong, I won't stop it, but we'll just aim for that.
Yeah, one thing on this idea of like ineffability and inspiration and these kind of mystical or like non-verbal experiences that I think are a really important part of synchronicity. You know, the AI element, it's like, how do you write code for mystery, you know? And I know I'm probably not articulating this question very well. I don't have much of a science or AI background. But, you know, going back to this idea of art and the idea of like the subjective nature of sync, I really feel like there's something here that's hard to articulate. It's more of like a mystical or experiential knowledge. It's very, very important in this whole discussion.
And yeah, well, again, if we got to factor in those lower or higher dimensions of the self or human psyche, or there's a non-local nature to things, so we don't even know how we're tapped into that at all. And so we're like, oh yeah, we'll know how to make the robots. Just like humans. So we don't even understand ourselves.
What did I hear? I think maybe, John, this might have been somebody you had on your show. The guy who was talking about the computers that write the, like, the basically, like, quote-unquote journalism.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And, I mean, first off, that was a horrifying thought.
Yes!
But it was also, I couldn't believe... I mean, how literally Orwellian that is,
insane.
Right? When they talk about there are lines in 1984 where he's talking about the computers that write the books. There's like, we send it to the novel writing machine. The novel writing machine pumps out books for the proles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, or here's this computer that's supposed to, like, report the news to you. But this, I mean, it's scary on all these different levels, and this is why I wanted to sort of bring it back to the structure of language, like the McLuhan sort of medium is the message, again, this sort of Burroughs virus of language. I'm just curious here, like, I dropped out of college, but I started college as a journalism major. And I just thought I'd like to become a journalist. And then I took a few classes, and I was like, fuck this bullshit. But basically, the thing that kept getting drilled into us was this idea that there is a formula through which there is an ideal formula for how you're supposed to write an article. And it kind of makes sense. I will admit that it makes logical sense. But it's also, it's playing to the lowest common denominator. It's basically your first paragraph should summarize the entire event, because a lot of people won't read more than that. So your headline conveys a certain amount of information. Your first paragraph should try and encapsulate the entire story so that people can, if that's all they read, they kind of know what happened. And then you can kind of, it's almost like Russian dolls, you know, where you can kind of like, all right, now you can expand that a little bit more, but you should still be able to come full circle. Then you come out a little bit more, and you should still come full circle. And that they had this sort of nesting way for people's short attention span. And this was how you wrote newspaper articles. This was how you wrote whatever. And it, it so appalled me as someone who thought, I want to be a writer. And I was like, oh my god, this is, I couldn't just plug these facts into these formulas every day. That would drive me crazy. But I guess my point is that, on one hand, when I hear about the journalism robots, I think, oh, but they're not human. And then at the same time, I think, like, ah, but is a human practicing mainstream Western journalism really using their humanity either? So that's sort of where I just sort of want to throw that out there, if anyone has a thought on that.
Well, that definitely seems to kind of exist today in terms of, like, I mean, if you especially consider that people are really only reading headlines, I mean, most, you know, like the Huffington Post is a journalism algorithm, you know, I mean, and it's just aggregating a bunch of content based on a profile of you and people similar to you, based on cool similarities or other demographical similarities. And I mean, in a way, that's kind of, it's a software robot.
I think about Ezra Pound here. I think about his idea of make it new. That was kind of his directive for poets. And I think it's a nice summary of even like from the literature perspective of what actually is considered literature in its age. It's like what turns on it. It's literature is that which turns on its head the existing linguistic forms that are present in the like literary in vogue. You know what I'm saying? And so I think there's a process of atrophy. And then in order for life to, it's going back to this novelty idea, like even viruses, I mean, they thrive like new territory, right? And so, you know, these journalism bots, I mean, I don't know, I think you see it in our culture, like Sandy Hook is real, or, you know, that's, there's sort of like a bifurcation, I feel like, of realities. There's the mechanized, accepted, sort of mainstream, but then there's this whole underground, this underbelly of like, open-mindedness, exploration, make it new, explore different pieces, kind of thing, so.
Yeah, Go ahead, John.
I feel that, an AI being was to come up, it would have to sort of make itself, right? It would start off with a code of some kind, and that code would have to expand and expand upon itself, so it would be making itself, right?
Yeah, and it would have to start from, when you think of where DNA actually comes from, it just started out as a...
Yeah.
A flow of energy in a certain type of atmosphere and climate, or in a certain amount of chemical broth. So at a time there was nothing physical as far as we understand it. So DNA isn't even prime. Like this software, we think of DNA as software, as like the thing. But where did DNA come from? And what program was running the energy flow that created the DNA? It's like we're literally embedded in this sort of information matrix that seems to, you know, maybe like what you're saying, John, is like it exists, but it's beyond space-time for us. And so in the same sense, it's like we could never build AI in the same sense that humans were created or anything. I don't know what that creative spark, right? And this is, you see it in varying degrees in nature, but humans have the greatest ability to abstract and create symbol sets and create novelty. And it's just like, it's almost, if you look at the basic tenets of biology, it's like, we're useless. It's like, why are we still here? Like, why do we have these faculties? And like, why in this way? You know, termites and ants and these creatures are beautiful examples of biological survival. Not necessarily evolution, because they've stayed the same for millions and millions of years. But humans are always like teetering on self-destruction. And it's like we're either a great mistake or the chosen ones or something. But it's like, what do you do with that responsibility one way or another, whether it's for nothing or it's for everything? It's still a responsibility.
Is the, when you say they haven't evolved much, but the great survival potential, is that like the ultimate play it safe, conservative sort of, you know, and it's like, or you can be, we're the reckless, you know, we're going to change at all. Change or die.
But you see what happens with if humans are conservative, though, like an insect, because our symbol set is so rich, we create something like we've created now, which is just like hyper-industrialization that's robbing the earth of everything, and we get locked in. We get locked into that after the fact. So if we stay conservative with a shitty way of doing things, we kill ourselves and kill everything else. And so we need to be able to adapt quick. Or, I mean, that's the way. It's like we should always be changing because we're too dangerous to be conservative, like lower animals or whatever. I hate that term because they're not lower, but as far as having a capacity for degrees of freedom of thought. So, I don't know. Those are, like, interesting questions, and so I don't know if we're, useless or somewhere in the middle. It's hard to know. But, I mean, it's cool. Whatever, it's cool being human. it's a weird experience, at the very least.
You have another?
I was just saying, follow the white rabbit. That's what's coming to my mind. You know?
Yeah, right? It's just, like, a bottomless pit of speculation. But so interesting. It's like, I was reading a lot of Robert Anton Wilson this past week, but he brings up Timothy Leary, and he's like, you know, Leary's tenet was, once you start thinking and learning, and you start getting smarter, you get addicted to it. It's like, and not to put ourselves on pedestals as these great, you know, thought leaders or anything, it's just like, I don't know, there's a lot of intelligence here right now, I can just recognize it, it's not. it's not an academic question. It's just like an obvious thing, and so, yeah, bumping into those kind of people or interacting with those people or trying to encourage that kind of thought, just like, hey, if you want to get addicted to anything, there's like knowledge is amazing. Gnosis. I mean, the Gnostics were onto that at least. It's like, I don't know if it's the Black Iron Prison or not, but it's like you really do ascend through learning. And then, but also integrating a certain amount of lived experience, because if you're just in your own head, then you're kind of fucked. But it's just that ability to do that that's really incredible, if we choose to do it, which we often don't.
Did I see Missy come back?
She finally came back. She said, fuck all you guys. That was what she told me to tell you. And she was really pissed off, but then I'm sitting like,
fuck all y'all.
Yeah, I'm just like, come back. Come back, it's fine. No one.
I had to drop off a costume client. Come back.
Yeah, you caught us for a little while longer, so better than nothing.
We're happy to have you back, always.
Yeah, it's.
If it's not top secret, what was? I'm just curious if there's any. What was the costume?
It's a black and white sort of cosmic duality, star meets butterfly, rainbow, very misty costume. All of those things. Is it rainbow in the dark, basically? No, it's red. She has, in burlesque, they're called Isis wings. So, she has, it's like a black and white Isis wing that transforms into gray when she twirls. Mm-hmm. And the top of the elastic harness is black, like a black star inverted, and the bottom is a white star. And they meet in the middle, right in her boob shadow area. It's very great. With like a nude body stocking underneath that has a that'll have like a bunch of butterflies basically all over. So as she kind of picks off the different layers of fabric, it'll be revealing rainbow colored butterflies.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it'll be really pretty.
I just want to say, I had a friend that was a belly dancer, and she came to one day and she's like, do you know they're actually called Isis wings?
Yeah.
She's like, she started listening to some of my podcast stuff, and she was like, I didn't know what that was. And she's like, no, they're called Isis wings. And I was like,
yeah,
that's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
And guys, I'm going to have to bow out here. I just wanted to say it's great chatting and wish you guys a good couple of weeks. Thanks for the talk.
Same here. It was great, great talking to you, man.
Yeah, nice talking to you, as always.
Nice, Misty, as well. All right, guys. Peace out.
See you later.
Take care.
Bye. Sweet dreams.
You too.
And then Misty, did you meet Wally yet? I don't know if you knew Wally. Wally's new this
week. Hi, Wally. No, I didn't get a chance to meet you. I'm sorry. I had to duck out right when you started right when you started talking.
No problem. Nice to meet you. Go on.
Nice to meet you, too. Really good. Thank you. Actually, I just got moved into a new apartment and officially spending my very first night here, so it's kind of nice to have you guys with me.
Wow.
Don't feel so lonely.
It's like a housewarming party.
Exactly. Yeah.
But, Wally, where are you again on the West Coast?
I'm in Oakland, California.
Oakland.
Okay. Bay Area.
Okay.
Yeah. That's... Where is it? Where are you guys?
I'm up in Vancouver, Canada. I was just in San Francisco. I was just in San Francisco in December, actually.
Oh, wow.
Oakland.
Yeah, that's where I am. Yeah. I love Vancouver. I'm very jealous.
Vancouver's really, really beautiful.
It's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And John, where are you at?
I'm in a big smoke, Toronto.
Oh, okay.
Nice. Awesome.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned that. I'm on the East Coast right now. I'm in New York, upstate New York. So I'm not too far from Toronto, actually, John. I'm probably like, they built a ferry to get there at one point right in my backyard, and then that project got bailed on. So I would have been a ferry ride from you if my town and city didn't fuck up, but you're pretty close.
Were they up the Hudson?
No, it was Lake Ontario. We were going to cross Lake Ontario to get to Toronto. That was the plan. It did not work because they're incompetent. And then,
Is Toronto the one that's really close to Buffalo?
Yeah.
John, how far are you from Buffalo?
An hour.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay. 45 minutes to the border.
Yep.
Gotcha. And where are you, Alan?
I'm presently in Virginia.
Oh, nice.
I'm not from... No, not nice. But...
I like that whole part of the world.
I actually just moved into a new apartment 21 days ago. Or 20 days ago, I guess. And I actually really like it here. I'm very, very happy here. I have not liked Virginia very much until 20 days. But,
hey, Alan.
Yeah.
What did you think of that coin I sent you?
What coin?
The coin, Egyptian coin.
Didn't get it.
No? Did you get that spoon?
I didn't have the heart to tell you. It didn't. You remember?
Dear.
You know how the first time you sent me something, the envelope was all ripped up and there was some stuff inside?
Yeah, yeah.
I took a picture of it. The post office gave me a plastic bag with some pieces of a wooden spoon, but not even all the pieces.
Oh, dear. Well, I'm just going to have to send you another one.
Well, so let me
send you... Can you see the video? Can you see the video right now?
I see you.
Yeah. Yeah, you like that?
That's gorgeous, yeah.
Yeah, I'll send you that one. You're going to have to send me your address.
I have one of your spoons sitting on my desk right now. You sent me, I wish I had a camera on this thing.
Yeah.
But,
The Purple Heart spoon?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the coin that I sent you was, it was an Egyptian coin, and it had, Tutankhamun's face on it.
Oh, wow.
But it's just like this one. Maybe you can see it. Like this. Can you see that?
Okay, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I was the sister of this coin. My cousin bought it back for me. And I thought you'd like that. But how do you forget it?
I appreciate the thought. Like I said, I didn't have the heart to tell you.
No problem, man.
It was a really sad thing. It was like, oh, here's a package. Oh, it's... The post office is giving me some pieces of some shit that got destroyed. I think in a regular envelope, they feed them through those machines, like the letter sorting thing.
Yeah.
Smashes it.
I'll have to do something else. I'll put it in a box next time.
Yeah, let me send you some money. for a box, and you know, if it's extra shipping.
So only like $4, $4 or $5, pretty cheap.
But yeah.
Well, I was just wondering what you thought of the coin, because I was trying to slip a sink in there of some kind. Sometimes just to see what happens.
If I had gotten the coin, I would have used that to scratch off the tickets. John sent me Canadian Lotto tickets that I only scratched off like two of them, and then I was like as first start, I was like, but I was like, you know, I have to wait. There's gonna come a moment when the moment's right, they'll be winning tickets.
Or yeah. I've heard stuff about you.
Anytime that I've won the lotto, it was like I knew I was going. So I was like, maybe there'll come a day where I'm like, now is the day to scratch the tickets. Mm-hmm. But
I always operate on intuition with things like that.
Yeah. We went, it was so funny because... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say I always wait for the right moment because I'm sure that's when the number has changed to what I need it to be.
That's the thing. The number inside will change depending on the time.
It's like, I feel like it's in constant flux. While
yeah.
Exactly.
It's Schrodinger's cat.
Exactly.
Is it a winner or a loser? I don't know until I open it. Right, it's both
it's
until I open it.
Superposition.
Yes.
Nice.
So I'm like, well, if I scratch it now, it's a dead cat.
Exactly.
Maybe there's
exactly
gonna.
Exactly it, Alan.
I went with my wife to when we were driving back from California over the summer, we stopped in Vegas just for like literally like we're driving through, and I was like, Will Morgan had given me a few bucks that he asked me to play because ever since people heard I won the lotto a bunch of times, they're like, oh my god, you have to buy me scratch offs, you got to play the lotto for me. Like, I don't think it works that way, but sure, you know, whatever. So we stopped into this casino and we go up to the roulette wheel, and my wife's like, how does it work? And I was like, okay, well, you pick the number and blah, 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 right? And so I said, you know, okay. And she puts the money down, and the wheel spins, and we lose. And she goes, she was so upset. She's like, I don't get it. I thought you win. I was like, no, I didn't come here saying we're going to win. This is called gambling. I was like, if you don't know,
house wins.
I was like, let me introduce you to two different things. There's intuition, like, we have to get in the car right now and drive to Las Vegas, because we're going to win a fuckload of money. Or there's, hey, Will Morgan asked us to throw some money to the roulette wheel. That's called gambling. There were two very different things. We gambled and lost.
Like, I also once got really mad.
Oh, she was so
I also once got really upset at a roulette wheel because at the Rio casino, they used to have penny slots and nickel slots, and so you could go in with $20 and play penny and nickel slots all night, and they would give you free drinks, like free beer, and there was like $1 beers in addition. So I spent like 6 hours gambling on these penny and nickel slots and finally worked my way up to like $12 worth of winnings, which I was so stoked about. But I was also shit-faced at that point in the evening from all the really excessively cheap liquor. And so I exited through the casino, and the first thing I saw was a roulette table, and all high on my $12 winnings. I slapped it down, was sure I was going to win, and then just like in the blink of an eye, it was like 6 hours of my life didn't even happen. I was so mad I cried. I actually cried, like, leaving the casino.
I'm sure you're not the first person to cry leaving the
computer. The look on the guy's face at the roulette table was just like, it was $12. Calm down. I'm like, but I just worked so hard. Like, I worked so hard for that.
None of it was fun leading up to the $12. It was
Roulette is evil.
Roulette is amazing.
It's evil.
No. So I'm telling my story real quick. I'm trying to do this really quick. And I don't say this, this was the misconception. I hate telling this story because everyone thinks that I have like super lotto powers or some shit like that. It's just a story. This is what happened to me. I don't claim to have any control over it. This is what happened to me. As a kid, I decided on my 21st birthday, so I grew up in New York. The closest place you could gamble was Atlantic City, New Jersey, right? So I said, on my 21st birthday, I'm going to go to Atlantic City, and I'm going to play roulette, and I'm going to play the number 14. So on my 21st birthday, my brother says, hey, come on, I'm taking you down to Atlantic City. I said, okay, cool. But I'm a kid. At 21, yeah, I have no money. So we get down there, and I have like 25 bucks, whatever it is. So we get to the roulette table, and I go, okay, and I put my money down on number 14. And it's like a few hours to get down there, get there, put the money in the thing, the wheel spins, boom, I hit, I win. I win a few hundred dollars, right? And I said, okay, let's go home. He's like, what? I was like, yeah, that's it. Came, played the number, won a fuckload of money, let's go home. Right, this will pay my credit card bill, and, you know, let's go home.
Cash out.
Yeah, exactly, cash out, go home. And he's like, okay, right? About a year later, I'm with this girl and we're out on a date and I have no idea what the fuck to do. And somehow we end up on a bus to Atlantic City. And then I realize I don't really have much money in my pocket. And we get down there and I was like, she goes, where are we gonna stay tonight? And I'm like, well, like sleep on the beach or, and she's like, looking at me like, no motherfucker, I have to sleep on a fucking beach, you know? I'm like, well, I don't have money for a hotel. I was like, well, alright, I got 15 bucks. Let's go to the roulette wheel. Go in, put it down. I found the same roulette wheel where I won with my brother. I go in, put the money down. Boom, I win. Take that money, cash out. Okay, let's go. Right? Go back a year later. The same fucking thing. I won, and I did the permutations of it. I think it was four times in a row, like that. Okay, I went to a casino, the experience you had, where I went to a casino, and it was in Connecticut, and we got there at like 2 a.m., and we go into the casino, and I was like, alright, I'm getting me a fucking drink. And we walk in, like, oh, sorry, we don't serve liquor anymore. I'm like, what do you mean, it's a fucking casino? Like, give me a drink. You know, and they're like, no, Connecticut state law, you can't serve alcohol after 2. I'm like, you're on an Indian reservation. You're not allowed to gamble in Connecticut either. Give me a fucking drink. You know, it's like, no. It's like, all right, we're getting out of here. We're going home. We're going all the way back home. You know, whatever. But, no, we just got there. So I'm playing slot machines, playing all these things that I don't actually feel any connection to, and I'm losing. And I was like, man, there's no roulette table. I'm walking all around the casino. I can't find a roulette table. I was like, that's my lucky thing. That's my lucky thing. Finally, on my way out, I find a roulette table. And the minimum bet was 25 bucks. I had 25 bucks left. I said, okay, put it down. Boom, win. Go home. So, roulette can be, in my experience, has been amazing. But, again, this is why my wife was so upset. It's like people then think, oh, Alan, I'm taking you to Atlantic City so you can go win me money. And I'm like,
yeah, I'm going
to
send you some more lottery tickets.
But the thing is, I was like, I don't think it works that way. I was like, it was just like in that moment. It was the zone. I don't know. Right? Like that was...
I think it's like definitely, there might be something to that being in the zone with affecting probabilities. I mean, they already know you can kind of affect dice in a small way. In controlled experiments, so it's micro PK. It's proven. Again, proof. I'm just using these words.
Right. It's when you know you're going to win. Perhaps
it could be a premonition too, right?
Yeah, or self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm. What if your knowing is actually influencing it, right? It's this idea of when we talk about confidence, doubt, all that sort of stuff. If I walked in there and I know without a doubt I'm going to win, perhaps my belief has actually influenced the outcome. I don't know. I'm just totally speculating.
Well, especially, go ahead, John.
I used to play a lot of poker, and there's this one game where you get three cards, right? Mm-hmm. And if you lose, if you don't win any hands, you have to match the pot. So I was playing, and I had the nuts. Sorry, I had every card below the nuts, so like the best three cards. Like weren't the best, right? They were the second best three cards. Three times in a row. And I lost to the guy with the nuts three times in a row. And every time I knew I wasn't gonna win, but I went on math, right? Like it's mathematically impossible, not obviously, that I'm gonna lose all three hands, right? And I did three times in a row. Most times, I think almost every time that I remember, anyways, I feel like this is true, that if I win, I already know that I'm going to win, or I totally forgot about the possibility of winning,
right.
and it comes up, and I'm like, I didn't even know I entered this, right? But yeah.
It's so funny. I used to play a lot, too, but in the States, did you play online or live?
No, always with, like, Italian guys.
Yo, okay.
And Phil the Pill, it was Hugo, and all kinds of crazy people.
Oh, man, I like, that sounds really fun.
Sounds like university professors and mafiosos.
And they all think they can play, and they all suck. And and you only lose when you have your second nuts run into the first nuts. Over and over and over again. But that shit happens. It's fun. Like, variance is an interesting thing.
Yeah, I was up $1,500 and I went down in three hands, went down to $2,000.
Dude, that's brutal.
Three hands.
Yeah, it's like, it can just like, that's why you need a bankroll. A lot of people don't play with a bankroll and they just go broke. Because you have to know that you're going to go through streaks when you just hit horrible, horrible luck.
Yeah. After that, in the game we were playing, you weren't allowed to borrow money from your buddy anymore. If you didn't have the cash, you couldn't play anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. How big was the game?
No, like, normally it was just like that particular game that went really high. Normally, if you bring $200 with you, you're fine.
That was good.
Like, you wouldn't lose or you could win more than two, but you couldn't lose more than two.
Right. Oh, God. I'm starting to reach the end of my rope here. Do you guys want to call it a night?
Oh, dude, I got to be at work in a few hours.
All right, so we'll let you get some sleep.
Yeah.
Thanks for sticking it out.
Yeah, of course. This has been real pleasure.
This is like almost like an always record, man.
I got an hour and 12 minutes of it. So right after Alan started talking about 137, so we got some good content.
Yeah, when Wally was talking with Zappa and I realized, we're having a real conversation, I texted John and I said, tell me you're recording this. And he's like, I'm not, but I can.
right after I sounded really smart, then I started recording, so I missed, of course, my best contributions, which I'm really sad about. But whatever.
John, I don't remember there was a point in which you sounded really smart.
It was.
Me neither.
Who are you talking to?
Fuck everybody. Whatever.
Oh, that John. Yeah.
Okay. Well, did you get that thing?
I did. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, I'll check that out.
It's really cool. It's interesting.
Yeah.
It was a podcast about this guy that made a dummy of Frank Zappa and. Hilarity ensues.
Yeah, I think that's the expected outcome of making a dummy of Frank Zappa. So, yeah, I look forward to that.
Oh, and synchronicity, too. It's very synchronous.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's
Yeah, Zappa. Do you guys know Zappa's term xenochrony?
I love that. I hadn't, but I love it.
Yeah, what's
xenophony? Xenochrony. So it's like
crony.
Xeno is, you know, like a foreign, or like it's like the Greek root for foreign, I think, or strange, and then crony for time. And he invented that term to describe a technique he did in the album Joe's Garage and several albums later for his guitar solos. Like every night when he was on tour, he would record just his guitar solos. Or you have a separate tape recorder that would just record the solo, and nothing else. And then he would take that solo, and mix it with a recording of a rhythm section, like bass, keyboards, and drums that he records in the studio separately. And then he would put them together, just put them on top of each other, these two events that happened totally separately. And he called that xenochrony. So he would have, so it would be a guitar solo from like some gig in like, I don't know, Buffalo, New York, that he cuts into the middle of one of his tracks, like Keep It Greasy or whatever. And it's the everybody else in the band is playing in the studio and they don't hear the solo. So the result that you're hearing is these two separate worlds that he's put together, and a bunch of the solos on Joe's Garage are like that. And so you hear all of these accidental synchronicities that just, sometimes it totally falls apart, and sometimes it totally syncs up in ways that, you know, were obviously never intentional.
That's so
yeah,
awesome.
I mean, that's
beautiful.
Yeah, it's a musical technique that, you know, comes up a lot, like just the idea of, and recording allows you to really take that to an extreme, where you record one performance that's its own thing and then another one, and then you just combine them and look for, you know, the simultaneities that happen.
That's sort of what I do with my other show. So I help Alan and David and now Kevin do Always Record, but I do another show called Pentimental.
And
I do two separate interviews and just put them side by side. So I obviously can't overlay audio, but at the same time I can kind of make them a unit. And in the same way, you know, I have an electron and a positron crash together and something
totally.
Else comes out, you know?
So yeah, basically, a collision. It's a collision.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just like CERN, you know, it's just you're finding subatomic particles.
And particles that are never there until you slam that stuff together. Because like we wouldn't know those particles existed without those colliders, which is interesting.
But it's all jazz, man. It's all jazz.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I don't know. I could find it, but a long time ago on Always Record, Bill took, he called it Random Cuts.
Oh yeah.
So it's sure. In between episodes 19 and 20. I don't know if anyone's heard this.
I've heard that.
When I first heard it, I spoke to him and I was like, hey, why didn't you play this clip with this clip? Like, thinking that he was trying to weave, like, a conversation, right? And I was like, oh, man, it would have been perfect if you put this specific thing here. And he's like, oh, no, they were really random. He's like, I just took chunks from different episodes. And it's hard to listen to. It's hard to pay attention to in the fact that there's, like, five conversations going on at once. He just overlays five different podcasts.
Yeah.
And then sometimes it's like you realize, oh, they're talking about the same thing. And then sometimes it's not, you know, whatever. It's, language is a hard thing to layer that way. But I just feel like I would be remiss if I didn't mention that such a thing actually was done.
Totally. Well, it's like that scene in Amadeus when he's like, he's pitching his opera to the emperor, and he's like, imagine how many voices I have, you know?
Yeah.
Yes! And he's like, 20, 20, you know? It's like, only music, you know, can have so many conversations at once and it not be a total chaos or whatever. That's what I just thought of all of a sudden.
No, I love that movie.
Oh, God, I've seen it so many times.
Yeah. That was how I spent my birthday this year.
Oh, right on.
I'm actually met Tom Hulce. He's one of the only, like, Hollywood people that I
Who?
Nice. Tom Pulci.
Yeah. Oh, is that how you say it? I don't know how to say his
oh,
last
name. Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. I said Hulse.
That might be right. I don't know. I'm Hulse.
Sure. We're both right. But, yeah, I worked at a pharmacy in, village in Manhattan, and I'd have, like, all sorts of different actors. Like, it was, like, the least glorious way you can meet a celebrity. Like, what's the guy, Chris Noth, Knopf, whatever you know who that is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I, you know, helping him find, you know, stuff for his constipation. You know, it's not really a good way to start a conversation.
Seriously? Really? You helped Mr. Big find him.
He was like, he actually ended up buying Metamucil.
That's a good choice.
That's awesome.
But, yeah. So, There's probably some law that says I can't say that, you know, it's private medical information.
You're going to get
Did you sign an NDA?
No. I lost my pharmacy license years ago for other things.
I'm so glad we stayed on for that.
But, yeah, so I did help Mr. Big get Metamucil. And then I met Tom. And it was the funniest thing is that everyone was like, you know, different celebrities would come in and everyone would be like, oh, look at that guy, it's whatever, you know? And suddenly, so Tom comes in and I'm like, oh my god, it's Amadeus. And everyone's like, what are you talking about? Who is this guy? You know? And I'm like, I don't know. That was a sad day for me because I realized that no one knew who the fuck he was.
Right. Yeah, he never, like, became an A-lister.
Yeah.
He's great.
But,
he was good in Parenthood.
We should put him in the Parent Trap.
There you go.
I was just thinking that. Get out of my brain, Alan.
I can't.
I know. I was just thinking about that. Did you? Okay, so I know you probably get like a million Facebook messages all the time. But if you just, for fun, want to scroll down and find the last message I sent you, it might be entertaining.
Oh, sure. I sent you something. Oh, I'm
Yeah, that sounds really kind of
dirty. You know, can I tell you something?
It's visual.
Oh, I am definitely, I am signing in right now.
See these eyebrows?
Wait, I gotta go back to you. Okay, alright. Okay, see you.
There may or may not
be a bone in it. Saw the eyebrows. The dumpster god.
I'm making you a comic book character.
That's awesome.
The conspiracy of my life. I feel like you're the, you're gonna be the dumpster god, and you don't actually have a presence in the story. You're sort of like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
Really, really cool.
I'll send you the updated version.
This is awesome. You know, when I first looked at it, I thought it said, the dumpster goo.
I like that better!
I'm the dumpster goo? What are you say?
Dumpster spunk! Uh-oh.
Oh my god.
Can I tell you guys something real quick? Say that Facebook, if you don't sign into it for like a month, it's even weirder. Facebook is already like, I'm not sure what the point of this is. And then if you don't look at it for a month, you come back and you're like, what are these people doing? What are they talking about?
I know, and it just keeps going. It's like the song that never ends.
Yeah, and I was sort of like, I signed in yesterday or the day before, because I had to send someone a message. I didn't have any other way to get to them. And I sort of scrolled for about, like, so I'm doing now, I'm scrolling for like 30 seconds. I'm like, eh, all right. It just kind of keeps going like that.
It's endless.
But I'm glad that I signed in to see your amazing dumpster goo.
Okay, so if I want to continue to send you random brain barf, where do I send it?
Oh, you could say, I mean, I'm sure, listen, I'm not, I can't get. Oh, don't be sad. Don't be sad. I'll sign it to Facebook. I'll sign it to Facebook just for you.
Okay. Just to check in on your also, comic book character.
Yeah. There's also, I don't know how it works of texting from Canada. Does that work?
Yeah.
Yes, it does work.
I can totally text you. That's dangerous, though. Do you have an iPhone?
I don't have an iPhone. I got a $10 smartphone.
Ooh.
It's some Chinese knockoff smartphone. That works well enough.
I gotta get one of those. I'm using a fucking flip phone. It's horrifying.
But well, that's just it. Like, basically what happened was, alright, so we built the web, Guillaume and I were building the website, like, you know, doing this whole thing, and then we built the members section, we all this sort of stuff. And, like, basically, the project took so fucking long, and I was getting so fucking broke. So, as soon as it was, like, done, I, like, boom, went back to this job, and I was just working, like, crazy hours. Well, of course, what happens is, I don't check my email for about a week, and in that time, some guy had emailed me and said, hey, I bought this membership thing, and it wasn't working. He was having trouble logging in, and it was some glitch that we did wrong, and blah, 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 and I was like, oh my god, this is totally unacceptable. I just sold this guy this thing, and it did some fucking work, and I didn't get back to him for a week. I was like, unacceptable, and I just went to the store, and I was like, I need a phone that can check email. And I've resisted a smartphone for so long, but I was like, I need to be able to see an email that never happens again. So, I got a $10
phone. Why do you have an aversion to smartness? Explain why.
You know, I remember a time when, like, if people were standing around.
I remember the sound of clicking buttons.
I remember an age of eye contact and, like longer than 30-second attention spans where you could be talking to someone before their head just drooped down and they're like, huh? Yeah, click, 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 Yo, Bob, sorry, what'd you say? I remember an age when that didn't happen. And you know what?
Well, that's when you just flick them in the forehead.
I've had this thing for like 2 months now, and I feel it happening. I've done that. I've done it now. When my wife says something to me, and I'm like, huh? I'm sorry, I'm looking at the screen.
My nephew the other day, a little while ago, asked me, so what did you guys do before cell phones? Somewhere and you can't make it. They're like, what do you do? And well, you use a landline, man. You know, like, how often does it happen?
A
where
phone booth.
Yeah, it just does. You know, occasionally it'll happen, but then occasionally your batteries die.
Ah, yes. Good point.
Wow, this picture is exactly what I'm talking about.
Exactly. Yes. Check out the link. And that was in 2012. I mean, God, it's gotten so much worse.
For real.
Ugh. I ride the train every day to work, and, like, if you're looking up, you are a leper. I mean, if you're, like, you look around, you're the crazy one. Seriously. Like, people momentarily, like, look up, and they'll see you, and they'll just, like, whoa, and they're, like, right back down.
That's why, like, that's why I like not having one. It's not, the temptation's not even there. I have to fixate on the ugly world around me sometimes. Well, most of the time. So, I feel like there's some sort of existential benefit from it.
It has benefits. I read a lot more with it for some reason. I finish books for some reason.
Oh, really?
If I read them on my phone. It's very strange. But
well, not. I mean, it isn't. It isn't. Like for me, it's a bit of a turnoff. But I guess I haven't. I don't know. Our nervous systems all work differently.
It's true.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's the simplest way of putting it. But hey, whatever makes you take in information, it's like that's what it's really there for. Honestly, it's like it's just people fucking use it for such super.
Well, for me,
nonsense.
Like just seeing a big block of text, not even considering what it contains, just the chunk of text was always just like, oh God, you know, like and because like whenever I would read, I would just daydream, and so. And then if it's like a chunk of text and it's a stack of pages of chunks of text, I'd just be like, oh God, that's too much. But if it's on this little screen, I'm like, oh, I can read that.
Yeah.
You go, oh, I can read that. Oh, I can read that.
That's a good point.
You know, and like I'm reading these 5-page books, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember one time I finished a book on the little Kindle app or whatever, and just by chance, I was in a bookstore and thought of it and went and found the actual book, and it was like this thick. And I was like, I've never read a book this thick, cover, ever. And I did, and it was mind-blowing, but I think it was just like a psychological trick, you know, I was playing with myself to like get over that fear of having to commit to a fucking stack of text, you know.
It's like a magical act. I mean, that's really what like a lot of magic is, just altering your own perception to experience reality differently.
So I totally understand, though, like, I deliberately try to not use my phone when I'm commuting, but I also appreciate that for my attention span, it seems to work as far as reading.
You know? I can respect that, yeah. So, are we good signing off for now?
Sure.
Okay, sorry.
It's been really, really nice to get to talk to everybody tonight. Yeah. Though. Like I hope everyone enjoyed this even half as much as I did. So
very much so.
Yeah, this is really good content. I used to think that it was my school. Wow, 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 wow. I was the king of every school activity. But that's no more, oh mama, what will come of me? The other night we painted posters. They played some records by the coasters. Wow, wow, wow. A bunch of pom-pom girls looked down their nose at me. They had painted tons of posters, I had painted 3. I hear those secret whispers everywhere I go. My school spirit is at an all-time low. I'm friendly and I'm charming, I belong to